Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Let me take you on a journey to the coldest place on Earth and its last and greatest wilderness, on a voyage to Antarctica. Hello and welcome to A Voyage to Antarctica, brought to you by the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. I'm your host, Alok Jha. In part one of this special two-part episode, we heard from Dwayne Fields about his life and work as a polar explorer. Today, I'm delving further into Antarctica's colonial history with historian and climber Dr. Ben Madison. Ben's book, Class and Colonialism in Antarctic Exploration, looks at the discovery of Antarctica from below. It focuses on the sailors, the sealers, whalers, cooks, and engineers who were all essential in bringing the upper-class hero explorers to the continent and supporting their expeditions. He's currently writing A History of the Southern Ocean, gazing out on his subject matter from Bruny Island in Tasmania, where he lives. When not writing, Ben engages in his lifelong passion for exploring wild places and has pioneered climbs in Australia, Greenland, and North Wales. Ben, let's talk about your own trips to Antarctica. How many times have you been?
I've probably been, probably 25, 30 times.
Does it get boring going to see the same old white space?
Well, it's never the same old white space. On the one hand, in the general picture, it is the same. And it's like going to see just a friend, because it's like, oh, and because it makes you feel good. It's like, oh, that is fantastic. I haven't seen you for a while. It's absolutely wonderful to see an iceberg again. That majestic creature, the iceberg, that will eventually melt and become, you know, a little crystal of ice and then finally gone. So there are those parts of going to Antarctica that are never old, and it's never the same Antarctica during climate, because not during, I mean, there is no such thing as during climate change. With climate change, Antarctica is changing. What we see there changes. And going there for long enough, you can actually start to physically experience that yourself, which is interesting to be a part of that magnitude of change.
Is there a trip that stands out for you?
One of my most memorable trips, Alok, is when we were on that crazy stuck in the ice trip in 2013. And that always sticks in my mind as one of the most beautiful trips I've ever had, because I always wanted to stop one of those tourist ships that I was on right in the middle of the ice and just inhabit it for, more than 3 hours in one particular place. And that's what happened on that trip. and as well as many other things. So that is certainly one of my most memorable trips into Antarctica, because we stopped. And I thought that was a fantastic thing to have accidentally happened.
Now, in this podcast series, we've discussed the history of Antarctica in great lengths and talks about the heroic age and the explorers. A lot of the history is white and male. Obviously, that's not the whole story, though. And we've touched on some aspects of that already. But can you give us a sense of your research into the history of Antarctica and how you're trying to broaden the white male sort of stories that the world knows?
Look, I first became interested in engaging in this sort of revisionist history of Antarctica when I was employed as a historian on Antarctic tourist ships. And I started reading all the Antarctic histories that I could get my hands on, because I didn't really know too much about Antarctic history. And I was absolutely amazed, as a professional historian with a background in labour and working class history, I was absolutely amazed about the incredible absence from the history books on Antarctica of working people. It was as though the ships sailed themselves to Antarctica, the sledges were hauled across Antarctica just by phantom beings. It just happened. And so my instinctive sort of intellectual and political response was to investigate more deeply the underpinnings of the heroic achievements of Antarctic history and Antarctic exploration.
And so what kinds of people are we talking about? Because you're right, when you hear about the Scott or Shackleton or Mawson expeditions, I suppose there's a mental shortcut. You think, oh, well, these guys just made it to the continent by themselves and sailed their own ships. And of course, that's not true at all.
Well, it's not true at all. So I'm looking at the sailors who sailed the ships, and then quite often those sailors became the sled haulers and the sort of the proletarian strata of the Antarctic land-based expeditions. But I'm also looking at a whole range of other people that never really make it properly into the histories of Antarctic exploration, like the people, often boys, who were sealers in the early 19th century, late 18th and early 19th century, so up to about 1825, the sealers who were a big part of the early human engagement with Antarctica, and in many ways they were explorers as well. And we often don't know the names of most of these people. There were thousands of them in the early 19th century, early 18th century, sorry. And we don't know their names, but nonetheless, they were there. They were part of the process. And then we leap forward to the early 20th century, and those anonymous proletarian masses, they're in the sealing industry. So we're looking at sailors, we're looking at the people who worked as cooks and mechanics in the early 20th century, a whole range of these sort of people who never get named, really.
We've been hearing from a British explorer called Dwayne Fields in this series, and he's in some respects a non-traditional Antarctic explorer. He was born in Jamaica. He comes from a working class background in London, the kinds of backgrounds that don't traditionally go off exploring in the polar regions. The polar explorers that the UK is familiar with are the sort of middle class, upper class, almost aristocratic explorers that you hear about. And the stories you're telling me now about the sealers and the working people who went to Antarctica in the heroic age, you know, there's parallels. And I wonder if you could tell me a bit more about the kinds of places that the people you're talking about came from. Where did they how did they end up going to Antarctica? What was their route to that place? Because, you know, and how is it that we don't know about them?
So if we take, some of the very first working class explorers into the southern regions, not necessarily into Antarctica, but into the southern, deep, close into Antarctica, going way back to Magellan's time, they were actually prisoners, convicts, who were taken up from the jails and put onto the ships as conscript explorers, basically. So we obviously don't know their names, but we know very much that they were sort of coerced into undertaking these roles. And then we jump forward several centuries up to the late 18th and early 19th century with the sealing industry, and what we do know is that these, and they were mainly male at this point, these young, and they were mainly, a lot of them were young boys, they were teenagers. And I'm thinking of one young lad who was a part of a group of shipwrecked sealers on the Kerguelen Islands in the early 1820s, who came from Essex, and he was 16 years old, and he spent years and years, 4 years shipwrecked on the Kerguelen Islands before he was rescued. And a lot of the people who worked on these ships were very down and out. They were, the sealing industry was the home for, as far as I can see, for the people who really had very little options in British society and American society. So the other interesting group of workers that come into the picture here with the sealing industry, and they reappear again in the whaling industry in the early 20th century. And they are a group of workers who were brought from the Cape Verde Islands into the sealing ships stopped at the Cape Verde Islands in the early 19th century for salt, for curing the seal skins. And they also picked up young indigenous workers on the ships, and they took them down to Antarctica. And we don't know much about them, but we do know that we have a few examples of, or evidence that they were there. And that's in the early 1820s and so on, and 1840s. And then by the early 1900s, the early 20th century, they are back there again. And they were back there in a remarkable way in the whaling industry on the Antarctic Peninsula and South Georgia. One of the things that fascinates me about this group of workers is that they are Africans. They are anonymous. We don't know their names. And they were described by the British inspector of whaling on the Antarctic Peninsula in 1923, as slaves. These were enslaved Africans working in the British whaling industry in 1923 in Antarctica.
That's not something you hear about very often.
That is not something you hear about very often, for probably good reasons. It's hard to create a romantic view of Antarctic history when you include in it these kind of experiences and these kind of circumstances in which people found themselves in Antarctica.
Given the fact that these stories are lesser known, I wonder, how did you go about uncovering them? Where did you go for your information about these sealing expeditions and the people who were on them? It sounds as if they were almost, they weren't even seen as people, and they weren't recorded. There's no stories told about them. There's no books written about them.
Well, it's quite interesting because there is a paucity of information about the people that I'm interested in. It's no accident that there's a paucity of information. All the naval powers required all their personnel to surrender when the expeditions had returned, all their information that they had gathered, notes that they had taken, diaries they had kept, pictures they had drawn, and remarkably, even up into the early 20th century, photographs that they had taken of on their Antarctic employment. So there's an intentional effort to control the information that is flowing out from Antarctic expeditions to the wider world.
Who is the organization?
The organizations are the expedition leaders and the financiers, the people who finance the expeditions. They're controlling it. In the first place, it was the British Admiralty that required all their personnel to surrender up to the Admiralty any records that they had created, any artifacts that they had created during their period of service. So the question then of how do you get the information is a very interesting one, because there's an intentional effort on the part of the authorities to control what information comes out. But nonetheless, there are always a few cracks in that plan. The plan never is completely, totally effective. So, for example, one of the most crucial expeditions in Antarctic history was James Cook expedition in 1775, the second expedition went very close to the Antarctic continent. And one of his sailors, an Irishman named John Marra, when the expedition got back, wrote up an account of the expedition. And it was highly critical of the authorities. It was highly critical of the aristocratic tendencies of many members of the hierarchy of that expedition. And so that is available. That is now reprinted. So that's one way of getting into it. A number of the sealers who fell on really hard times after their period of sealing left accounts of their time as sealers, because they were trying to use this as a way of a way of making an income in the middle of the 19th century. This is when there was a bit of a vogue for 19th century exotic adventures in Europe and in England. So they would write their accounts of their period of shipwreck or their period of life as a sealer, and give us many details about the lives of people who are at the bottom of the Antarctic hierarchy.
Could you paint a picture of what life would have been like for some of these people on these expeditions? I mean, we've talked about some people being coerced onto these ships as slaves or as prisoners. We talked about people being left to row along unknown coastlines by themselves to look for seals. This sounds like a very hard and life that either you're coerced into or you do if you've got no other options. I mean, is that the picture you get from your research?
Well, what is remarkable about the accounts that come from the lower decks, if you like, that from John Marra in 1776, right through to the members of Mawson's expedition in the 1911-12-13 period, they are all displayed incredible awareness of the class basis of Antarctic exploration, and they also display an incredible awareness of the fact that, totally against the whole heroic and Antarctic romantic vision, they would rather be virtually anywhere else but Antarctica. They don't want to be working these ships. They don't want to be spending days breaking the ice from the sails breaking the ice from the decks so that the ship can sail. They don't want to spend all their time up to their waist in freezing cold water. They don't want to be wearing anoraks that they have to waterproof with paint. They don't want to be doing this kind of work. Incredibly harsh. And if you go, the worst was, well, the sealers were, you know, a lot of these sealers were employed on these ships for in terrible conditions, often in the middle of Antarctic winters or Antarctic storms with bare feet, having to pay for their own footwear, quite often not getting paid at all if the cargo was went rotten or the ship sank or anything like this, or if they didn't find any seals, they wouldn't be paid at all. So very, very harsh conditions of work. When you get up to the land-based sledging expeditions, really the heartland of the heroic achievements, the Scotts, the Shackletons, the Amundsens, the Mawsons, there's a whole group of people underpinning those expeditions who do the cooking on these expeditions. They do the sledge hauling on these expeditions. They do the maintenance of the equipment on these expeditions. So the distinction between classes was really quite stark.
Hello, I'm Camilla Nichols, CEO of the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust, and I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. We work to preserve and protect Antarctica's unique heritage, from the historic huts of early pioneers to the amazing discoveries in climate science. And our mission is to inspire current and future generations to discover, value and protect this precious wilderness. The pandemic has had a significant impact on our work, and we need your generosity now more than ever. Find out how you can help save Antarctica, protect our planet, and even adopt a penguin at ukaht.org, or search for the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Another issue that's come up repeatedly in this podcast series about the history of Antarctica is that we know about the stories of the heroes. We know about the stories of the sort of aristocratic men, the white men mostly, who went to the continent. But that clearly there were women, there were clearly people of colour who had been to the continent. You've talked about some of those already. Mm. And I wonder if we could just go back to what the history is of people of colour, women on the continent, but from a more realistic perspective rather than, just the ones that we know have been written about.
We have sort of prominent contemporary individuals like George Washington Gibbs Jr. and Barbara Hilary and Duane Fields, who allow us to, and their examples allow us to sort of tell a bit of a different story about Antarctica. But before them, there was a big backstory of non-white connection into Antarctica, and you can take it right back if you wanted to into the histories of Australian Indigenous peoples in the Pacific and Aotearoa New Zealand, with their oral traditions of explorers that go deep south from in the middle of the Pacific, and this is sort of in 700 at the current era, and come back with reporting things that sound like icebergs. So it can go way back there, and then there's the whole Indigenous observations in southern Australia and southern New Zealand about what is the meaning of the aurora australis, the southern lights. What does that mean about what is down there? But more tangibly or more close to our own time, we go back to the sealing industry and the whaling industry. And both those industries, being maritime industry, global maritime industries, brought people of colour into wherever they went. So there was a big connection between South Africa and the sealing industry in the sub-Antarctic islands of the Kerguelens and other islands around there. And although it's little mentioned, there's no doubt that there some of the people who were there were in there were of African heritage. There's little. It is well known now that many people in the early whaling industry were from the Pacific Islands and from Aotearoa, New Zealand, and from places in Australia as well. So that is that connection goes way back. And then we come up into the heroic era, and the very first land-based expedition, the Borchgrevink expedition to Antarctica, 1898 to 1900 or 1901, took with them two indigenous people from what was called Lapland in those days, the Sami people, as experts, as polar experts. And those people brought their knowledge of how to survive and how to operate in polar regions. The Japanese expedition, the Shiraza expedition in 1910, also brought two Ainu people from what is now the Russian island of Sakhalin with them as polar experts. And the whole paraphernalia of the heroic era expeditions, or much of it, was based on indigenous knowledge that was appropriated in various ways by the European and in this case, in the Shiraza case, the Japanese expedition.
Could you talk a bit more about George Washington Gibbs? The history books say that he's, in 1940, the first African-American man to set foot on the continent. We've talked already in this conversation about how there were people from Africa who were on that continent before. How does he fit into the story?
My view is that individuals like George Washington Gibbs Jr. And Barbara Hillary, so those people had unimaginable struggles as people of color to break into the white men's club. Not a woman of color to break into the white men's club of Antarctica. Unimaginable struggles. But nonetheless, I think I resist bringing them completely into the story in the sense that do they become the new people of color heroes? So I'm against the whole notion of heroism and the heroic narrative of Antarctic history and Antarctic exploration. So these individuals, and I'm not trying to diminish the struggles that they had to do what they did, but if we think about Antarctic history as a series of prominent individuals, then I think it leads us inevitably back into the heroic discourse. So that's my starting point for thinking about George Washington Gibbs and Barbara Hillary and Duane Fields. So behind, underneath them, you know, and in a century before them, there were people of color, and I suspect there were probably even Chinese people who were a part of the sealing process in Antarctica.
How should we think about these untold stories? You've uncovered many. There are probably scores more people that we don't hear about when it comes to the traditional views of Antarctica. And I just wonder, it's very easy to, it's very simplistic to just think, oh, well, this is just another episode of whitewashing history. These things, history is always told by the victors, and we know that. But how should we think about these things now? What should we be doing to try and bring out these stories?
And why would we do that?
And why?
Yeah. What's the point? What's the point of making these observations? I mean, my take on this is that it's important to know that the so-called heroes were there with the support of a huge number of people that were providing them with the basics of life, basically. Their achievements were built on the labor and the shoulders of an anonymous, you know, mass of people. And why is that important? For me, that's an important observation, because I think as we are in this era of hyper-individualism, the idea of the hero is becoming so powerful, and maybe it has been for, you know, since the 1960s, has become so powerful, and it attributes success to an individual personality, an individual set of qualities that I think is a real, really misleading view of how society operates. And these people weren't extraordinary individuals who engaged in these Antarctic heroic expeditions as leaders. They were individuals of their societies. And we always need to bear in mind, I think, that individuals are always products of their context. So I think it's important to know more fully what that context is. And then when we come to think about Antarctica in current times, for me, it's one of the most profound facts about Antarctica is it's one of the very few places on Earth that was a true, what we know in Australia as a terra nullius, that is to say, an unowned land, not unoccupied, but unowned land. It was also unoccupied, as it happens. And I think that has had profound consequences for how Antarctica is sits with us today. For reasons that I think are to do with the fact that Antarctica was a continent that was never had to be conquered, there never had to be an indigenous population dispossessed. It was never its ownership by the powers that have come to be stewards over it, has never been morally compromised by a violent process of dispossession. That is always the story elsewhere in the world. And I think that it's on this basis, and only on this basis, that it's been possible to create Antarctica as the continent of peace. You cannot imagine a continent that had been riven by ethnic, race, and genocidal processes could ever be described as a continent of peace.
That's very profound. And I think it's a very interesting way of looking at it, because I feel like the story you're telling also says that even though this is a continent of peace, the getting to that point still required the labor and the bodies of many, many people, indigenous people, people of color, who have been forgotten in getting there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons that I want to have their presence in the Antarctic story, much more evident.
Yeah, it's a strange type of colonialism. It isn't colonialism in the sense of going to a place and displacing the people who live there, but taking people with you to then forget about them to conquer a new place. I don't know how to think about it. Why does Antarctica matter to you?
You wrote me this question. I've been thinking, why does Antarctica matter to me? I'm thinking, actually, does Antarctica matter to me? I'm thinking, well, is Antarctica any more special than any of the other amazing places on the planet? And I think the answer I've come up with is, yes, Antarctica does matter to me, because it is such a great example of how history can make a fabricated view of the past, which is so at variance with what we need to know. I mean, I think it's a really good example of the role that historians can play in the modern world, because we can look at Antarctica and say, well, you know, we don't really have a proper understanding of it without having a historical understanding. Of course, you know, there are the tropes of Antarctica, the wilderness. Now, that trope is becoming less and less viable because it's becoming less and less a wilderness. Before COVID, the annual visitation numbers to Antarctica were about 40,000 or more. And I think that had increased from about 4,000 15 years before that. And yet it is still an incredible capsule on global climate history. And it's still an incredible place to dream in. And it's an incredible place to break your heart in with its beauty.
Ben, that's a lovely place to end. Thank you very much for your time.
It's my very pleasure.
Thank you for listening. A Voyage to Antarctica is brought to you by the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. Next time, I'll be talking to scientist Dr. Kelly Hogan to find out what studying the history of Antarctic ice can tell us about climate change and the future of our planet. To find out more about our guests, including photos and videos, head to our website at www.ukaht.org or follow our Facebook, Twitter and Instagram pages. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to follow us and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is part of the Trust's Antarctica Insight programme, supported by the Arts Council England, the Garfield Western Foundation, and the Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office. A Voyage to Antarctica was presented by me, Alok Jha, and produced by Jessica Norman. Ben Hewis is digital producer, and the music and sound design is by Alec Hughes.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.